Hello and welcome to the latest Residential Property Cases 2020 with me, Michael Large. I'm a senior associate at Coleman Coyle Solicitors. The law, as stated during this webinar, is up to date as of the 8th December 2020. And moving to my first slide, 2020, very unusual year for all of us. I think that's an understatement. And that has had an effect on residential property law. A lot of the year we have been in the world of residential property law litigation, certainly. We've been struggling or dealing with the moratorium, both on the residential, which has now expired, and on the commercial front, which, as I speak, hasn't yet expired. You'll probably be delighted to hear that no moratorium today. That's coming to an end fairly shortly, probably by the time you've had your you've watched this and had your Christmas dinner and everything else, that will be been and gone. So we'll leave that to one side and we'll go for what one might call the ordinary residential property cases from 2020, of which there haven't been an enormous amount, as you might expect, perhaps. What there have been quite interesting and significant, but not a huge amount of it. Next year, we hope to have a bumper year. We expect to have a bumper year because there will presumably be lots and lots of cases coming through and lots of interesting points dealt with. But for this year, it's slightly truncated, hence this webinar only being of half an hour's duration. But diving straight in to the summary, here you can see we've got a few cases under the Housing Act 88 to do with Section 21 notices and Section 8 notices, Section 21 being no fault eviction and Section 8 being fault based eviction. There's an interesting case on service of notice after death. It's unfortunately been a year of great mortality, and perhaps it's darkly appropriate that we have a case on service of notice after death in the midst of all this. There is the interesting Duval case on enforcement of covenants. Very interesting case on forfeiture, Mark Citelli. And on this slide, we have a waiver of the right to forfeit, which I see is a bit of a typo. It should that is actually a commercial case, but I can deal with it if we like. And lastly, there is the Tate case about nuisance and privacy. So those are our short roundup of cases from the year and the residential property front. Moving on to the next slide, and the first case is Tracarrell House and Bouncefield, and that is a Court of Appeal decision, and that is essentially the reversal or consideration and reversal of the decision of His Honour Jan Luber in Carradine and Schultz 2018. You probably all remember Carradine and Schultz. It attracted a huge amount of excitement and comment, and you can see comments and praises of it littered all over the internet. And great wailing and gnashing of teeth. In that case, in essence, the judge found that let me take a step back. This goes through the changes in recent years to the regulations surrounding service of Section 21 notices and the panoply of things that had to be done before a landlord could do that. For instance, the landlord had to serve a PAT test certificate, landlord had to serve the guidance on for renters on renting, landlord had to make sure that deposit was all nicely dealt with under the deposit, one of the deposit schemes, and all various other things which aren't relevant for our purposes, but the one that clearly is the gas safety. And the as part of that overall overhaul of the scheme, the landlord had to make sure that the gas safety installations in the property, assuming that there were any, not everywhere does, but most do, had the correct certificates and were safe. So they not only were safe, but had to be proved that they were safe. And in that case of Carradine and Schultz, landlord hadn't done that, and so the judge found that he wasn't allowed to serve a Section 21 notice and therefore couldn't get possession, or at least not based on a Section 21 notice. It's quite ironic that we have this decision in a year where it's been virtually impossible to get possession of a residential property, no matter what notice you serve. But anyway, here it is. And Carradine and Schultz perhaps unsurprisingly, has been reversed. What is interesting about it is the reasoning behind that, which I'll take you through. And the Court of Appeal considered paragraph 6 and 7 of the Regulation 36 of the Gas Safety Installation and Use Regulations 1998. And I doubt gas safety regulations been subject to so much scrutiny and so much comment, but these have been, and there's more of it here. The landlord was seeking to get possession of the property on AST by Section 21 notice, very straightforward. Hadn't done the gas safety before entering into the tenancy agreement. Did Section 21A of the Housing Act 1988, that's the Section 21A being the more recent amendments, did it require, amongst all those other things that I've talked about, the valid gas safety certificate to be served before the parties entered into that assured short-hold tenancy agreement, as Jan Luber had, his honour Jan Luber had found it did. And if it didn't, then when did those have to be served? Because it was evident they had to be served at some point. And the Court of Appeal looked at this and they found that paragraph 6 provided for two alternatives. Under paragraph 6A, copy of the certificate should be given to existing tenants within 28 days of the gas safety check being done. Alternatively, 6B applied, this is the gas safety regulations, applied where there were new tenants, and the certificate had to be given to them prior to them taking up occupation. So you have to give it first, then they go in, and then after they're in, because you can't serve Section 21 immediately, of course, you have to wait a few months now, then after a certain period of time, serve Section 21. And what happened here, the landlord had provided the certificates, they had actually done it. I don't think there's any question that if you haven't done it, you still can't get your use of Section 21. Had provided it, but after they occupied, and then he had gone on to serve the Section 21 notice afterwards. So he'd done it not perhaps in the correct order, as Carradine and Schultz would have it. And the Court of Appeal held that the landlord could remedy that breach by serving the certificate after the tenants went into occupation. So unlike Carradine and Schultz, the tenants go in, then the gas safety, then the Section 21, and that was held to be okay. And the reasoning, which is set out on the next slide, is quite interesting. And the Court of Appeal held the landlord could remedy that breach by serving it at that point because of these factors. Paragraph 24 of the judgment, the Court of Appeal looked at the sanctions for failure to comply with the 1998 regulations, the gas safety regulations, and they are criminal sanctions. And ultimately, that could be prosecution under Section 33 of the Health and Safety at Work Act 1974. And beyond that, pretty heavy stuff, the Court of Appeal went on to say in paragraph 24, a landlord whose breach of the regulations results in the death of a tenant may also have a potential criminal liability for manslaughter. So pretty heavy stuff here, pretty heavy incentives to comply on the landlord and to behave themselves. And the Court of Appeal felt that essentially in that legal matrix of swinging penalties, imprisonment and all the rest of it, the imposing a bar on serving Section 21 notice was pretty small beer. Or as they put it rather more elegantly than I, thereafter only collateral to these sanctions. And they also looked at the fact that the 28-day requirement wasn't in 6A, so they felt that this confirmed, in their view, that Parliament didn't intend those requirements to be applied across the board to all the new tenants with the same vigour. Paragraph 30, they looked at parliamentary intention again. They similarly found that this bar on service of Section 21 notice was an unlikely result for Parliament to have intended. They went on to say, and it's kind of probably enough for your purposes, I would have thought, but they went on to say paragraph 40, which I found quite interesting and doesn't appear to have had a huge amount of comment on it. Perhaps it doesn't need it, I don't know. But this for me is really the crux of it, which is a bar on service of a Section 21 notice in these circumstances would in effect change the assured short-hold tenancy into a fully assured tenancy with accompanying security of tenure. I'm not sure if anybody remembers assured tenancies. I certainly do. I've dealt with enough of them. I'm old enough to. But anyway, that, of course, being the older form of tenancy, enduring a great deal more protection. And it's very rare to see any new ones. Still quite a lot of old ones about, but not many new ones at all. And the Court of Appeal felt that it hadn't been Parliament's intention to, by the back door or accidentally or however you like it, to reintroduce assured tenancies on the basis of gas safety. So that is a reversal of Carradine and Schultz, essentially, and the landlord pretty much can remedy their default in serving the gas certificates. On the next slide, we have Section 8 notices. You can't really talk about Section 21 without Section 8. If Carradine and Schultz hadn't been essentially overturned, then Section 8 notices would become an awful lot more important, but they're still pretty important. And Section 8 notices and typographical errors, and if you, my little joke, you can, the lawyer's joke, you can see my extra R that I've slipped in there, capital R, which you may have noticed if you're paying close attention, which I'm sure you are. This came up in the context of Section 8 notices, but the Court of Appeal, another Court of Appeal case, took the opportunity to have a bit of a roundup and a gallop through the authorities on errors in notices, which is always welcome, and they took as their basis Manai and Eagle Star. And this case is Pease and Carter, and the lead judgment was by Lord Justice Arnold, and there are four key points to it, as I see it anyway. That is, first of all, statutory notices should be interpreted in accordance with Manai. Manai and Eagle Star, not a huge surprise. And as we all know, as understood by a reasonable recipient reading it in context. Point two, if a reasonable recipient would appreciate that the notice contained an error, for example, as to date, maybe if you had put the 8th of December, say, which is today, which is a Tuesday, and if you put Monday, the 8th of December, that sort of thing, and they would appreciate what meaning the notice was intended to convey, that is how the notice is to be interpreted. Then consider whether, this third point, then the parties move on from that to consider, or the judge considers, whether, if interpreted in that way, the notice complies with the statutory requirements. Of course, you'll remember in Manai that it's as understood by a reasonable recipient reading in context, but you have to comply with any prescribed requirements. That's your baseline. If you don't, you don't get through. So having got to this point, we look at the statutory requirements. But in Pease and Carter, the court took a slightly softer line than in a more forgiving line on the drafters of notices than Manai and Eagle Star, in my view. And in Manai and Eagle Star, it's a bit of a, you've either done it or you haven't. It's kind of a tick box exercise. Did you comply or not? If you didn't, tough. Even if the reasonable recipient wouldn't be misled, if you haven't done that, then that's it. They took more of a purposive interpretation. And does the notice comply with statutory requirements? Look at the purpose of the requirements. And that leads us to the fourth point, which I think is a useful point for anybody who's trying to argue that the notice is valid when it may not be the most perfect notice in the world. And I'm sure we all, what people watching this, draft absolutely perfect notices, but I'm thinking of a situation where somebody else has drafted it clearly. Even if the notice, properly interpreted, does not comply with the statutory requirements, it may be possible, and this is, again, for me, this is quite a softening of the Manai approach, it may be possible to conclude substantially to the same effect, substantially to the same effect as a prescribed form, if it nevertheless fulfills the statutory purpose. So we're looking at purpose rather than strict, absolute formal compliance. And even if that was held to be the case in Pease and Carter, interestingly, even if the error relates to information inserted into or omitted from the form and not to wording used instead of the prescribed language. So it might not just be that you have the prescribed language, you have the warning there, but the prescribed language is a little bit off, but you might even potentially be missing some of the information altogether. So it's a bit of a, for me, it's a real softening approach. It's a lot more forgiving on those who serve notices and harder on those who receive them, I guess. Moving on to the next slide. This case, I don't think it's had an awful lot of attention. It's a little bit of a niche because it applies to the situation where the public trustee is involved, but nevertheless, I think it's quite an interesting one and quite apposite in a year where, sadly, we've all had to face our own mortality to a certain extent. And this is Gateway Housing Association and the personal representatives of Mohammed Nuruj Ali and Dilara Begum, Dilara Begum being the second party. And this is from 2020, of course, and it is yet again in the Court of Appeal. And in that case, we had the personal representatives, the PRs, who were at the property, and the landlord Gateway Housing Association served notice both on the property, on where the personal representatives were living, and also on the public trustee. And the tenant argued that there were two notices, and as they gave different expiry dates, the claim should be dismissed because it was impossible to work out what the correct expiry date was. This went to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal found that if the notice to quit is served on the public trustee before the original notice to quit, that is the one served at the property, expires, then it complies with Section 18 of the Law of Property, Miscellaneous Provisions Act 1994, and the tenancy ends on the date specified in the original notice to quit. That point on the slide probably should make that clear, but it's it goes on to explain that very clearly in the next point. So you have a bit of a race here that you serve the first notice at the property, and then as long as you run off to the public trustee and get that one in there, as long as the first one hasn't run out, then you're okay. The tenant argued in that case that the landlord should have done both at the same time. The landlord should have had the same notice and done at the same time and had kind of a pincer movement or a more synchronized approach, if you like, and got them both done at the same time. There is something to be said as a matter of good practice for doing that, and I'm sure we've all had situations where we've ended up doing that or something similar to that, and it might even be a good idea to do it in practice if you want to avoid room for argument. But notwithstanding that, that's not what Gateway says. You don't have to do that. According to Gateway, you can get your first one in and then run off and do your other one as long as you get it in within the time that is before the first one expires. And the next point on the slide here makes very clear the original notice is the operative notice. And as long as you then get the copy in later, then you're okay. The landlord, so they won their appeal, but there are a number of other issues raised by the tenant, which went back to the county court. Whether we'll see them again, I don't know. Remains to be seen. But that is the crucial point to take from this. It's an interesting point more generally that tenancies, residential and commercial, potentially don't end on death. It's a right in land. It's not a personal right. So it's a question that I have come up quite a lot. The tenant's died. Has the tenancy died? Not necessarily. Moving on to the next slide, enforcement of covenants. So we're getting away from the world of short-term tenancies and that sort of thing into the world of long leases. And this is Duval and Randolph Crescent Limited, or 11 to 13 Randolph Crescent Limited, from fairly early in the year, back in May, which probably we're struggling to remember what was going on back in May, I suspect. A lot of talk about Duval and Randolph through the year. It's quite familiar. I've had it quoted at me on occasion, not necessarily correctly, but it's come up in correspondence through the year already. So it's something that people are quite familiar with, but I think it's worth going through and looking at, because like one of the other cases in this roundup, it contains like several, in fact, of the other cases in the roundup, it does contain some useful restatements or explanations of how the law stands, and it's quite a useful guide to where you have a clash of covenants. It's worth a read for that reason, if nothing else. So this was a Supreme Court decision. I'm getting away from the Court of Appeal. I'm up to the Supreme Court with this one, back on 6 May. houses converted into block of flats, which we're all familiar with. They were on long leases, 125 years, starting in the 1980s, so lots and lots of time left on them. And the leases contained an absolute covenant by the leaseholder or the tenant not to cut, maim, injure any wall within or enclosing the demised premises. Now, that's an absolute covenant. It's not one where you can have consent not to be unreasonably withheld. There's no implication of reasonable consent, nothing like that. Just you can't do it, full stop. And if you want to do it, you're going to have to come to some kind of agreement with the landlord. And if the landlord won't agree, tough. There's not a great deal, if anything, you can do. So set against that, there was a separate covenant by the landlord. And these are quite usual. Lots of leases have these in. To enforce any covenant entered into by another tenant, if that tenant requested it, if the tenant put their hands up and said, no, I want that enforced, and if that tenant provided security for costs, which actually in Duval, or I don't think it makes a great deal of difference to the principles here, was a full indemnity. The tenant had to fully indemnify the, which is quite usual in these clauses, the landlord for their costs. And the, as you can imagine, as you can see, this is heading up for a clash of the covenants. One of the leaseholders asked for permission to do works involving cutting, maiming, or injuring a structural wall. Just as an aside, the structural wall involved was also outside the demise. So it was part of the common parts, if you like. They were cutting into something that it wasn't simply they were cutting into something demised to them. They were actually doing works on something demised to, I guess, everybody in the building. The claimant wasn't happy with this for a number of reasons, and they sought a declaration opposing it, said, no, you can't do that. And they had, doesn't make it clear on this part of the slide, apologies, but not only they didn't just seek a declaration, but they actually said to the landlord, I want you to enforce the covenant, and I will give you your indemnity. I will satisfy the requirement of the clause, and I'll give you your indemnity. And the deputy district judge, the landlord, as you can imagine, it would have gone slightly differently. The landlord said, no, I'm going to allow this. I've already agreed with the tenant to who wants to do the cutting and maiming and injuring that it's fine, that they can do it on terms. I've already agreed this, so I'm not going to enforce the covenant. I'm not interested in your indemnity. That's it. The work's going to get done. And the claimant sought a declaration opposing that. And the deputy district judge, that he came before, granted a declaration that the landlord could not waive the covenants without the consent of the other tenants. And indeed, that proved to be correct in the end, but by a bit of a roundabout route, the deputy got it right. The landlord successfully appealed to a circuit judge, and then the claimant, tenant, that is the claimant who was opposing the work, successfully appealed to the Court of Appeal. And the Court of Appeal, we'll go through what it found, but the landlord then applied to the landlord then appealed to the Supreme Court, and that failed as well. So it went up to the Supreme Court, but it was basically found on the basis that the Court of Appeal had found. And the Court of Appeal held that the claimant, the tenant who was opposing the works, had won, and it was implicit in the covenant that the landlord would not grant consent where, but for that consent, another tenant would effectively be able to enforce the covenant. As I mentioned, the Supreme Court agreed with that, and it's very useful if you go through the detail to consider how to interpret interrelated or contradictory covenants in leases. Paragraph 32 contrasts absolute and qualified covenants, bit of a difference of approach. I mentioned that at the start of this one that it was an absolute covenant, that the which is an important difference, that the landlord, the tenant who wanted to do the works just wasn't allowed to do them, full stop. There was no issue of consent being granted reasonably or not. They just weren't allowed. Paragraph 33 deals with the covenant to acquire enjoyment and the effect that that has on these questions. Paragraph 34 deals with derogation from grant, and without going too much detail, essentially the Court of Appeal held that this was a derogation from grant. Paragraph 35 deals with it in the context of nuisance, and 36 and 41 deal with the enforcement covenant itself. There's quite an interesting roundup of previous cases where by doing something, a party makes the performance of its obligationary covenants impossible. And in that case, there is essentially a collateral or implied term that you shouldn't do that. There's an interesting roundup in the authorities of the old breach of promise cases on marriage, which is all completely out of the arc now, and some of the younger viewers will wonder what on earth I'm talking about. But those are sort of cases where gentlemen promised to marry a lady, then gone off and married someone else and sued for breach of promise. And essentially there was an implied term that if you promised to marry one person, you wouldn't run off and marry someone else. And essentially that's the same reasoning here. Paragraph 47 considers implication of implied term that the landlord shouldn't act in a way that's inconsistent with the enforcement covenant. So if you said that you're not going to do one thing if somebody objects, and then you run off and do that thing when they've objected, then you're in breach. And that you would think is fairly common sense. And indeed, if you go back to these old, fairly archaic cases, that you'll find precisely the same reasoning in there. Next case is forfeiture. And this is Marchitelli and 15 Westgate Terrace Limited. And for those of you who are finding the it all a bit of a slog, that's a bit of a salacious one, and there's some racy goings on here. The decision of Martin Roger QC, Deputy Chamber President of the Upper Tribunal, and like Duval, it contains an interesting roundup. It's a kind of a nice how-to guide, but in this case, it is dealing with forfeiture rather than breaches of covenant and cross-covenants, which Duval was talking about. So here we have a long lease for dwelling again, and the landlord may not serve notice, as we all know, on a dwelling for forfeiture unless, and let me hasten to add, that is setting aside questions of moratorium. It's not concerned with any moratorium, statutory bar, anything like that. Landlord may not serve, we're going back to normal if you like on this. Landlord may not serve notice for forfeiture unless a breach is admitted, or there's a final determination by an appropriate tribunal, or there's an application under section 168 of the Common Hold, 1684, that is, of the Common Hold and Leasehold Reform Act 2002. The leaseholder here had a finding against her at first instance in the first tier tribunal that she was in breach of covenant by allowing the flat to be used as a brothel. So there you go, that's the salacious bit. The leaseholder appealed to the upper tribunal. If you read the case report, there's lots of very interesting shenanigans and goings on, and advertisements and all sorts of stuff in the case report that some people might find interesting. But it's there's an awful lot of very salacious and racy detail in there. So there were some goings on in there, shall we say. And the upper tribunal found that there was enough evidence to establish that the flat was being used as a brothel, which if you read the case report, isn't surprising. But the FTT had made, and this is where it's an interesting point, had made no express finding that the leaseholder had permitted or suffered it to be used for that purpose. So whilst it had been going on, and the landlord and indeed the FTT had gone, it's been going on, it's your fault, there you go, breach, forfeiture. There was kind of a gap in the chain here, in that whilst it had gone on, there wasn't any finding the leaseholder, Marchitelli, had permitted or suffered it to be used for that purpose. Whilst it had gone on, had they allowed it? Had they done it? Or even, there certainly was no finding to that effect whatsoever. There was no finding they'd been involved personally, and the flat was sublet. So had their subtenant been permitted or suffered to do it by Marchitelli? There's no finding of that whatsoever. That kind of gap in reasoning was just that there was a gap in the reasoning, it just wasn't there. So we've gone from A, instead of A to B to C, we've gone from A to C, as it were. And this was what the judge found in the upper tribunal, that the determination of the breach needed the same degree of detail as a valid notice under section 146 of the Law of Property Act would need. So it wasn't sufficient to establish the property had been used in breach. It was also necessary to show that the tenant's, that is Marchitelli's, action or omissions amounted to permitting or suffering the particular use in question. So really interesting point here, an interesting difference, that you've got to show that culpability, that it was their fault. For instance, I think we'd all agree that had the situation been that somebody had let their flat to a tenant who seemed, subtenant who seemed perfectly bona fide, and then, you know, gone off on a round the world cruise for a year or something like that, and come back and found this happening and kicked them out, we'd find, well, there's no direct culpability there, clearly. And that is the sort of reasoning that we're dealing with here, that you can't go from the one to the other. You've got to show that link. So it's a very important judgment for guidance as to how applications for forfeiture should be considered. And the two essential points to take from this are these. The requirements for a valid Section 146 notice must be met. That is in the decision that's made, or however it's arrived at, so that no lessee could have any reasonable doubt as to what the breaches were specified. And secondly, it's essential that the County Court is in a position, from the FDT decision, to assess the seriousness of the breach, the culpability of the tenant, and the appropriate response to an application for relief from forfeiture. You can imagine situations where a leaseholder might turn a blind eye to what was going on, or not bother, or be absent for inordinate periods of time and not care or take any interest. You can imagine all that sort of thing going on, and that might or might not be sufficient for the lease to be forfeited. But what the County Court has to know are those factors. They have to have that information that to make that, those findings, to make that decision to assess the seriousness of the breach, whether the tenant was at fault. And from that, it's not always that you can't always get relief from forfeiture, but the appropriate response to an application from relief. So they need to have all those findings at their disposal, so they can make that decision based on it. And if they don't, then the likelihood is they won't. And that brings me to on forfeiture. You'll notice nobody feels short's changed. There's reference to the Ferenakavasu case, and that is has snuck its way in to one of my opening slides. And what that says, that's a commercial one, but so that nobody feels they've been shortchanged here, that is the case on relief from forfeiture, where the courts found that CRA would operate as a waiver of the right to forfeit. It is a, using CRA being a commercial recovery of arrears of rent. So CRA has snuck into this residential talk here. The courts have found that doing that would amount to a waiver of the right to forfeit. You might ask, would it amount to a waiver during the coronavirus moratorium, where only a written waiver amounts to a waiver? I don't know, who knows? Well, maybe we'll find that next year. But anyway, so that's the relief from forfeiture case that snuck in. Moving on to the next slide, nuisance and overlooking. That's Fern and Tate. Or give its proper title, the Board of Trustees of the Tate Gallery. Again, that's the Court of Appeal. That had an awful lot of press, but it's an interesting, instructive case and worth looking at in the context of nuisance as it affects residential property. It involved the world-famous Tate Modern Art Gallery on the South Bank, and which we'll all have seen on TV if we haven't been there. I believe it's the most visited tourist attraction in the UK, or it certainly used to be, although probably not getting a lot of visits at the minute, I expect. And the Tate Modern redevelopment included an extension called the Blavatnik Building, and the 10th floor of that has a walkway open to the public, which has a panoramic view of London. Opposite the Blavatnik Building is a development of flats called Neo Bankside. And they have these flats have floor to ceiling windows, and both the Blavatnik Building and Neo Bankside were developed around the same time, and they shared a similar characteristic in that they both had panoramic views and floor to ceiling windows. And members of the public in the Blavatnik Building at Tate Modern could see directly into some of the flats, not all of them, but some of the flats on Neo Bankside, and they could see in unless blinds were installed or unless other screening measures were taken to stop people seeing in. And owners of four flats complained at Bankside complained that visitors were waving, making gestures, taking pictures. Also, the various other things, apparently the pictures being stuck up on social media and all that kind of thing. Now, what's interesting about this immediately is that Tate weren't happy with this. They didn't allow this to go on unchecked. They put up notices asking visitors not to do this. And beyond which you might think, well, so what? But beyond that, they instructed security guards to stop visitors taking photos of the flats. So pretty hefty action they'd taken. They obviously took it seriously, and good for them. And the claimants said, though, that this wasn't enough, it wasn't sufficient, and they sought an injunction to have the walkway closed, completely closed. And they argued the walkway was a nuisance, either under existing law or the Human Rights Act. And they argued that Tate was a body against whom the Act can be enforced. Moving on to the next slide. At the first instance, the privacy claim was, apologies for the typo on the slide, I've put HAR, it should be HRA, Human Rights Act. Section 6 of the Human Rights Act and Article 8 of the Convention, privacy claim was dismissed and the basis Tate wasn't exercising a public function. It wasn't a public body. I think that's fair. I mean, I believe it's in receipt of some public funding, but that's certainly not enough to make it a public body. And I think it's pretty fair to say that there's no serious question that it was or is a public body. Nuisance. If there was a nuisance claim, it was within Lord Lloyd's third category in Hunter and Canary Wharf. That's nuisance by interference with a neighbour's quiet enjoyment of land. But if it was such a nuisance, then at the first instance, that was also dismissed. And going through the next part of the judgment is quite interesting. And because of what it showed, real difference of opinion, where this might go, even though the results at first instance and on appeal were the same, Judge Mann considered that, in principle, such a claim could succeed. Because a tort of nuisance, absent statute, would probably have been capable, in principle anyway, of protecting domestic privacy rights. And secondly, the Human Rights Act and Article 8 contain a right to respect for an individual's private and family life. And the claim didn't succeed at first instance because the claimants occupied a sensitive property, but the problem arose because of the glass walls in their flats. Had they had ordinary windows and brick walls, not these glass walls, or even if they'd had screening and blinds and that sort of thing, nobody would be able to look in, so the problem wouldn't have arisen. So it was down to their sensitivity, if you like. That went to appeal, and the Court of Appeal upheld the decision at first instance, so Tate won, but for very, very different reasons. The Court of Appeal considered the relevant principles of private nuisance, and they looked to Williams and Waitstall, Williams and Network Rail Infrastructure Limited. So that is nice to see that particular case, which we're all familiar with from a couple of years ago, getting looked at again and being affirmed essentially as a strong authority. And the courts took from that the unifying principle, Court of Appeal took from that the unifying principle of reasonableness between neighbours drawn from the common law. And they disagreed that the law of nuisance could protect privacy rights, there having been no reported case to that effect in hundreds of years, and mere overlooking was not capable of giving rise to a cause of action in private nuisance. A very important determination of policy, and on balance, you have to think that simply has to be right. There aren't any such cases out there. And whether as a matter of policy, they looked at this again, they thought, well, all right, there aren't any cases, but should there be? Should this be the first one? Should we extend the tort of nuisance here? And the answer was no, because of the difficulty in coming up with some kind of test to see whether the amenity value of the land was affected. And secondly, because of the existence of other means of protection, such as planning laws. So planners, when they're dealing with applications, are meant to take into account things such as, including amongst other things, overlooking. So there are meant to be other mechanisms to deal with that, to secure those rights. So really what we were looking at was invasion of privacy rather than anything to do with property damage or property rights. And if there was going to be a privacy right, it was up to Parliament to pass laws to regulate that area. So that was really the situation, that it was a bridge too far. The Parliament was, if that was going to be done, Parliament had to do it. They also finally disagreed that Article 8 of the Human Rights Act had been breached. And again, given that this wasn't a public body anyway, hard to see where that was going to go. And that brings me to the end of this slightly truncated talk. It's gone long, a little bit longer than the half hour, so you've had an extra 10 minutes or so. If you've got any questions, by all means, get in touch. Drop me a line. You'll see my contact details on the slide. There is, on the slides, there's a roundup of the residential property seminar webinars, even, in the fourth quarter of 2020. And you'll see that Lexis have either or are in the process of preparing webinars on changes in process at land registry, conveyancing, changes in residential tenancy law, residential property law, end of year roundup, this one, and advising buyers of new builds. So please do check all those out. Finally, thank you and reminders. And this webinar is designed to help you meet your requirements of A2, maintain competence and legal knowledge, and A4, draw on detailed knowledge and understanding. So very helpful, this slide, for your CPD records. You can get those straight down, A2 and A4. A4 being draw on detailed knowledge and understanding. There's also a quiz, which there's only, because it's a bit shorter, there's only actually five questions. So I don't know, I'm not sure how many you've got to get, three out of five, probably, to, and you'll have two attempts at the quiz. Please submit your feedback via the survey screen, and the webinar will be archived immediately and be available to view on demand for 24 months. And you can always also get a transcript of the webinar should you wish to get that. And finally, it only remains for me to wish you Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And hopefully 2021 will be rather more fun and have a be better all round than 2020 has been. And stay safe.